The following teaching is part two in a six-part series by Dr. Ken Boa, titled, Great Books Everyone Should Know, Series 2.
I have already done a one-hour summary of C.S. Lewis' book, The Great Divorce. In fact, there's a little set of tapes you might want to look at called Great Books Everyone Ought to Know, and it contains six one-hour presentations of six great books. Everything from Lewis's The Great Divorce to Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov and so forth, Pascal's Pensées, Augustine's Confession. And therefore, because I've talked about the life of Lewis in that tape, it frees me from having to do that again today. If you want to know a summary of Lewis's life, you could get that tape set and hear the message on The Great Divorce, and I try to synthesize the key elements in his life. This is a good thing, because this book is so rich. That gives me a good 10 more minutes in order to go into it. Now, clearly, I'm not going to be able to go into all of this material. My only objective is to synthesize, by which I mean take all the little bits and pieces of the puzzle, put them together in a meaningful and coherent way, and then also to apply and translate them in such a way that I hope I'm not going to be dumbing down the material, but to make it clear and to see what relevance does this have for our lives. And so first, let's just look at the thought process in this book. As you may well know, Lewis really didn't write this as a single book. Actually, it was related to some broadcast talks that he did during the Second World War. And first he did The Case for Christianity and Christian Behavior. These appeared in 1943. And then Beyond Personality appeared in 1945. And then they were later combined together in this book, Mere Christianity, given the name by what Lewis refers to as Baxter's term, mere Christianity, by which Lewis means that there is some fundamental distinction, that there is really at the center of each of the communions in the church, whether Protestant, Catholic, or Orthodox, there is clearly some kind of where her true children dwell. Each communion is really closest to every other in spirit, if not in doctrine. And this suggests at the center of each there is something or a someone who, against all divergences of belief, all differences of temperament, all memories of mutual persecution, speaks with the same voice. That's what he's referring to. What's the bottom line? What's the essence? What do we share in common? What we might call creedal orthodoxy, those great affirmations in the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed would be what we would say, these are the key elements. Augustine put it this way, in the essentials, unity, in the non-essentials, diversity, in all things, charity. And so we understand then that there needs to be an essential, and so that's what Lewis is focusing on. What are the things that really matter wherever you are on that spectrum? And then he uses this marvelous image of being in a hallway, and he says, regardless of your communion, whether it's Greek Orthodox or Congregationalism, it's more like a hall, he says, out of which doors open into several rooms. If I can bring anyone into that hall, I shall have done what I attempted. But it's in the rooms, not in the hall, that there are fires and chairs and meals. The hall is a place to wait in, a place from which to try the various doors, not a place to live in. In other words, he's saying you go down that hall where we can all share, but eventually you want to discern what door are you being invited in? Which door are you being called to pursue? And having said that, he says, when you've reached your own room, be kind to those who have chosen different doors and to those who are still in the hall. If they are wrong, they need your prayers all the more, and if they are your enemies, then you're under orders to pray for them. That is one of the rules common to the whole house. Having said that, then, he begins his exploration. And there are really four books, because The Case for Christianity consisted of two little books, Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe, and then a little book called What Christians Believe. And so what Lewis does is he starts off from the whole experience that humans have of a moral sensibility, that all of us quarrel, if we praise, if we blame, we're appealing to some moral ought. He picks up from that and looks at the clues behind that, and then moves into a second book, What Christians Believe, and focuses on rival conceptions of God and the invasion and the incarnation of Christ, and looks at some implications that this would have for our lives. Then he moves from there into what he calls Christian behavior. Here's what he gets into: morality, into application, into real life practical application. And then from there, the beyond personality, or first steps in the doctrine of the Trinity. Here he uses a highly Trinitarian theology in order to embed the spiritual life, and tries to argue that the spiritual life is really the embracing of this new life in Christ, which makes us new people, a new kind of person who share the life of God in us. And he says that that life of God is really a Trinitarian life, a love that is the lover and the beloved and the love that flows between them. And so he really focuses on that and then draws some, I think, powerful applications at the end. And really, in my view, saves the best for end in this book. So let's take a look at some of the materials. And I'm just going to walk you through. I admit, the first two parts are the toughest because he's dealing in a more theological, or more of a philosophical level. And so I will just give you an overview of that without going into too much detail, but just to give you the storyline of where we go. Again, now, this is my class, so I get to pick the bits I like. So you might have bits that you like more than me. Well, you can teach your class and do that and enjoy that too. I'm just trying to think of the things that really crystallize it for me, and I think there's some wonderful insights we can gain together from this. So let's take a look at these first of all. In a chapter called The Law of Human Nature, he speaks of the law of nature itself, and he refers to his own book, The Abolition of Man, which came out a few years before that, back in 1940, which really, in my view, is a prophetic book that says, in essence, that really all the religions, all the cultures share some sense of a common morality, what he calls the Tao. And what Lewis means by that, and he just uses this term, we often think of Taoism, and what he means by that is that there is something that all religions, all cultures share in common. And he says, for example, think of a country where people were admired for running away in battle, or where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who had been kindest to him. You might just as well try to imagine a country where two and two made five. He's saying there are some things that all universal cultures embrace. And it's this thing that he says is part of what it means to be human, that we can inspect ourselves and realize there's something in us. Whenever you find a man who says he does not believe in a real right and wrong, you will find the same man going back on this a moment later. He may break his promise to you, but if you try breaking one to him, he'll be complaining, it's not fair. And you can see, all of us have experienced that sort of thing. He's using right and wrong as clues. He's using that as a way of looking at the human condition. For example, people say things like this: how'd you like it if someone did the same to you? That's my seat. I was there first. Leave him alone. He isn't doing you any harm. Why should you shove in first? Give me a bit of your orange. I gave you a bit of mine. Come on, you promised. People say things like that all the time. And when we do so, we're not appealing merely to instincts or to social obligations and contracts. We're appealing to something that really we believe is right and wrong. And so he develops that theme, and he suggests really that the problem we have here is that this very day we have failed to practice ourselves the kind of behavior we expect from other people. I don't know about you, but it doesn't take divine revelation to show that we do have a conscience that often condemns us when we discover that we, in fact, violate our own moral standards. We say we ought to treat people with kindness and with dignity and respect, and then we go on and treat people who may be the closest to us as in a way that's more cruel than we would with mere strangers. And you ask, why is that? How is it that we say one thing and do another? When you read Ovid's Metamorphoses, he says the same thing. I know and approve the better way, I choose the worst. Often we find ourselves doing that which we don't wish to do. Or Samuel Johnson, when he says, there is that in ourselves which we would not dare tell our dearest friends. There are certain things that he says are problematic. He says, when he talks about excuses that people use, that excuses are another point, a proof of how deeply, whether we like it or not, we believe in the law of nature. If we don't believe in decent behavior, why should we be so anxious to make excuses for not having behaved decently? You see the argument that he uses there. And so the point that he's saying here is that you notice it's only our bad behavior that we find all these explanations. It's only our bad temper that we put down to being tired or worried or hungry. We put our good temper down to ourselves. And so he's basically saying, in effect, that there is this whole process that we go through where we experience these contradictions. He goes on, looks at some objections, and talks about the herd instinct. He talks about the fact that often, though, we are encouraged to pursue things that are not actually instinctual at all. In fact, not our primary impulse. And we find ourselves knowing that that is the better course of action. He looks at the objection of social convention and says, who's to say which society is better than another if we were going to go that route? You see his point here. If we say it's mere social convention, then the question would be, then why would we be able to say whether one culture were better than another? And of course, the problem we'd have then is it would just be, if decent behavior meant simply whatever nation happens to approve, then there'd be no sense in saying that any one nation had ever been more correct in its approval than any other. No sense in saying that the world could ever grow morally better or morally worse. Yet we know that that's not the way we operate. The reality of the law, he develops that a little bit more, and I'm going to skip by some of his arguments, but basically he says that there is a law that really is there, that's undeniable, and one of the ways in which you want to learn about yourself is to look inside and see what you see. The only packet I'm allowed to open, he says, is man. When I do, especially when I open that particular man called myself, I find that I do not exist on my own, that I am under a law, that somebody or something wants me to behave in a certain way. And he develops that theme. He then goes on to talk about a contrast between that and what he calls a life force philosophy, because indeed there are two basic ways of looking at this. He talks about the materialist view and the religious view. Now, a materialist option would be, how do we understand these things? If we say from materialism, we would have to say then on this view, how do we even have the idea of morality? You would have to reduce morality to mere instinctual survival behavior and so forth. But there is that in ourselves which really seems to contradict that, and he goes and develops that argument. And then he talks about the religious view. But when we talk about that, what sort of religious view do you have in mind? And there he criticizes, for example, a sort of impersonal, what he calls life force philosophy, something that's an impersonal spiritual thing but has no personality. He says, one reason why many people find creative evolution so attractive is that it gives one much of the emotional comfort of believing in God and none of the less pleasant consequences. The life force is a sort of tame God. You can switch it on when you want, but it will not bother you. You have all the thrills of religion and none of the cost. That's what he's basically saying. Is the life force the greatest achievement of wishful thinking the world has yet seen? And, of course, I might translate that to the idea of a sort of New Age philosophy of some impersonal ultimate, whether it's higher vibrations or consciousness or so forth. If ultimately at the end of the day it's not personal, then it really is something that doesn't fully account for the idea of morality, because you cannot, for example, sin against an object. You don't ask, if you kick somebody's car door in, you don't ask forgiveness of the car for having done so. It might well be that the person whose car door you kicked may be the one you better approach. You see where that's going. That'll be where your issue is. You can't sin against an impersonal object. He develops this a little bit further and then says, we have cause to be uneasy, because he talks about this inside information. I mean, frankly, if you want to know what God is like, he says, you find out more about God from the moral law than from the universe in general. Just as you find out more about a man by listening to his conversation than by looking at a house he has built. So we discover something, and that something is in fact something that's wired into us. As he puts it, drawing his conclusions, you may want him to make an exception in your own case, this business of greed or exploitation or whatever. He says, to let you off this one time, but you know at bottom that unless the power behind the world really and unalterably detests that sort of behavior, then it cannot be good. On the other hand, we know that if there does exist an absolute goodness, it must hate most of what we do. And so he says that's a fix we're in. If the universe isn't governed by an absolute goodness, then all our efforts are in the long run hopeless. But if it is, we're all making ourselves enemies to that goodness every day. So he talks about a moral dilemma. We want to appeal to an absolute good to contextualize and make meaningful the idea of moral ideas and insights. But on the other hand, when we do that, we find ourselves condemned by our own behavior. How do we get off in this business? And so he deals with this theme of both loving goodness and hating it. From there, he moves on into rival conceptions of God and talks about a kind of majority view and a minority view. Here he speaks about the majority view as a belief in God or some kind of gods. And what he's referring to here is in rival conceptions of God, he's saying that the majority of people buy into that. The minority do not. But there's another big division, and that division is between people who believe in God and the sort of God they believe in. One of them has the idea that God is beyond good and evil. And the other one says that God is fundamentally good, and we define good as being what God is like. And so panentheism, for example, would say that God's beyond good and evil. Good and evil are illusions, and that these illusions are only caused by our relative perspective, that ultimately all these things can be merged into one. And so he deals with this issue, but then he talks about the issue of justice, for example. And he talks about the issue of if a good God made the world, why does it go wrong? And develops that a bit as well. And talks about his former objection. You know, Lewis's big objection was, if God created the world, then why is it so full of injustice and cruelty? Why does it seem so distorted? How can we account for that kind of a thing? So the problem of evil was what Lewis really struggled with. That's what he really bought into when he was an atheist. And he searches his own process that he himself went through. And he said, of course I could have given up my idea of justice by saying that it was nothing but a private idea of my own. In other words, why would I be so concerned about justice if ultimate reality is impersonal? Stop and think about it. What is the source of justice? If I am a materialist, then the idea of justice isn't contextualized. He says, but if I did that, then my argument against God collapsed too, for the argument depended on saying that the world was really unjust. Not simply that it did not happen to please my private fancies. As soon as I speak about the world as being evil, or evil in the world, I'm appealing to some kind of standard that really isn't just cultural conditioning, but is really wrong. So he says, thus in the very act of trying to prove that God didn't exist, in other words, that the whole of reality was senseless, I found that I was forced to assume that one part of reality, namely my idea of justice, was full of sense. Consequently, he said, atheism turns out to be simple, too simple. If the whole universe has no meaning, we should never have found out that it has no meaning. Just as if there were no light in the universe and therefore no creatures with eyes, we should never know it was dark. Dark would be without meaning. So he uses these kind of homely illustrations to drive his point home. But having said that, in religion, he speaks about Christianity as a religion you would have never guessed. And he speaks about the invasion of Christ and speaks about how that contextualizes and looks at the idea of how God deals with this issue, the issues he's been raising. And speaking about that, he speaks about a distinctly Christian concept that good and evil, that evil really does exist, but that evil exists simply because it is a parasite or a distortion of the good. Rather than saying that good and evil don't exist or that they can be blended into a nothingness, he is saying we all understand that there are some things that are right and wrong. But Lewis is going back to the Augustinian notion that basically evil is not a thing in itself but a parasite on the good. And he goes on to develop this argument, for example, looking at even things like sexual perversion or cruelty, and he speaks about how the badness consists in pursuing them by the wrong method or the wrong way or too much. I don't mean, of course, that the people who do this are not desperately wicked. I do mean that wickedness, when you examine it, turns out to be the pursuit of a good in the wrong way. You can be good for the mere sake of goodness. You can't be bad for the mere sake of badness. Even when you do something, even if you're sadistic, there's a pleasure that you are trying to achieve. There is some good that you are trying to accomplish, some power, some wealth, whatever. Those things are not intrinsically evil, but they can be the means by which they, or the direction that a person pursues, and it can distort them. Or perhaps more clearly, he puts it this way. He says, to be bad, God's got to exist and have he must have exist and have intelligences and will. He's talking about a good power. But existence, intelligence, and will are in themselves good. Therefore, he must be getting them from the good power. Even to be bad, he must borrow or steal from his opponent. And you now begin to see why Christianity has always said that the devil is a fallen angel. That is not a mere story for children. It is a real recognition of the fact that evil is a parasite, not an original thing. The powers which enable evil to carry on are powers given it by goodness. That is why, by the way, you see in Tolkien, in his Lord of the Rings, evil is presented clearly as a parasite in the good. And when the ring is offered, the ring of power, the one ring that binds them all, but even the other rings that they didn't know about, the one ring, these other rings were offered. And they chose to use these rings just as the ring is now being offered, or there's a temptation to use the ring. All these rings can be used for a good intention. Ultimately, if, for example, when Galadriel is tempted to take that ring, and she knows what she could do, and she realizes she could become powerful, and ultimately her intention to use it for good would actually corrupt her and destroy her very people. The idea here is you can use a wrong thing for a good intention, and the thing itself can corrupt you. And so the idea of a good being a parasite, the evil being a parasite on the good, that the imagery that we have here is that something was good and it was distorted. This world is not as it was meant to be. It was changed as a result of the fall, and we go back to that understanding. Here he also talks about the alternatives and talks about free will, that God does not want to create automata. It wouldn't be much of an interesting relationship for you to have a relationship with a machine that you program to tell you I love you. And God is interested in a being who can respond, but the danger there, of course, is that one can reject. And so you have this possibility as well. And he says the happiness which God designs for his higher creatures is the happiness of being freely, voluntarily united to him and to each other in an ecstasy of love and delight compared with which the most rapturous love between a man and a woman on this earth is mere milk and water. And for that, they must be free. Ultimately, he is arguing that our true dignity arises from our freedom of will, but that ultimately there is a choice then that we must make, that we cannot not make a choice, and that either we will be moving toward him or away from him. God cannot give us a happiness and peace apart from himself. Because it is not there, there is no such thing. When God says, I wish to give you happiness and peace and joy, he says, I am the wellspring of that. And if you try to find it in other sources, it will ultimately disappoint you, and you'll become bitter and disappointed and empty in the end. So he is saying that this isn't just an appendage. This is the very source of your well-being. And God's benevolence, he discusses that. Having done that, he talks about the various options. And there's a famous paragraph, perhaps the best known in the entire mere Christianity, about Jesus. It's called the Trilemma. And there he's talking about, what are the options about this one? And he is saying that, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, as does the Jesus seminar, for example, that sort of. But he says, but I don't accept his claim to be God. This is the one thing we must not say, he argues. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God, but let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about it being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. Now, there is, in fact, that whole idea of a trilemma. I'll mention, by the way, that really you have a sort of quintilemma, but I won't go into this in any detail. The bottom line here is this, that we have this liar, lunatic, and Lord option, that Lewis has just been talking about. But it's also possible that Jesus could have been a legend, and many people argue that. If he was not a legend, if we say no, then you have these options, if the accounts are really true. Or some people will reinterpret that, and they'll say that he was some kind of a guru. You know, he went off to the East or something like that, and what he was really teaching is esoteric truth that we now have lost as a result of the church and so forth. I won't go into those extra options, but basically, if we can claim that the New Testament documents are, in fact, reliable primary historical resources, then we would really be left with these options down here as Lewis develops. And that, of course, would be another argument, and we're not going to go into that tonight. So, let's move on from there. He then talks about the idea of repentance. Fallen man is not simply an imperfect creature who needs improvement. He is a rebel who must lay down his arms. And he talks about repentance. Repentance is no fun at all. It's something much harder than merely eating humble pie. It means unlearning all the self-conceit and self-will that we have been training ourselves into for thousands of years. It means killing a part of yourself, undergoing a kind of death. And so he talks about this whole idea of how in the incarnation, God takes upon himself our pain and our sin. And he says that we cannot share God's dying unless God dies. We cannot die except by being, and he cannot die except by being a man. This is the sense in which he pays our debt and suffers for us what he himself need not suffer at all. So having developed that, he then draws his practical conclusion to these first two books and says that in Christ a new kind of man appeared and offered a new kind of life, the Christ life. And he talks about this concept in terms of the fact, and this is an important point for you to catch, the Christian thinks any good he does comes from the Christ-like life inside him. He does not think God will love us because we are good, but that God will make us good because he loves us. Do you see the difference between that? It's not that God will love us because we are good. That's performance. But rather that God will make us good because he loves us, that he'll infuse us with his life and bring us up to the point where it will be possible for us to manifest that new kind of life. So that we understand then that having said that, we can see whether people who ask God to interfere openly or directly in our world, why doesn't he come now? And why doesn't he manifest directly? Why does it have to be 2,000 years ago? And he says, when we ask him to do that, they're not quite sure what they're asking for. When that happens, it'll be the end of the world. When the author walks onto the stage, the play is over. God is going to invade, all right. But what is the good of saying you are on his side when you see the whole natural universe melting away like a dream and something else, something it never entered your head to conceive, comes crashing in, something so beautiful to some of us and so terrible to others that none of us will have any choice left. For this time it'll be God without disguise, something so overwhelming that it will strike either irresistible love or irresistible horror into every creature. It will be too late then to choose your side. There's no use saying you could choose to lie down when it has become impossible to stand up. That will not be the time for choosing. It will be the time when we discover which side we have really chosen, whether we realized it before or not. Now today, this moment is our chance to choose the right side. God is holding back to give us that chance. It will not last forever. We must take it or leave it. So Lewis develops a theme that we see in a lot of his books. Namely, his argument is that we are eternal beings and that we are either moving toward one direction or toward another. And that I use this analogy, really, about the fact that if you were to live 70 years, we see a person changing, do we not? 70, 80, 90, 100 years. What do we see when we look at human beings? There are some people who become more joyful, more Christ-like as they walk with him as the years go by. And there's a quality of life about them that you can never see in an immature person. But we can also see the old phrase is true. There's no fool like an old fool. And there are some people who are so self-centered and malevolent, angry and bitter and crotchety. Suppose a person, though, could live 200 years and continue the journey. Suppose 1,000 years. You see where I'm going with this? It would move more and more closely to heaven or hell on earth if a person could live millions of years. you begin to see where we're going. We are beginning to create a persona, a person in us. And that central thing that chooses begins to shape us and our direction. And eventually we choose for and toward God, or we choose away from Him. But never is it a neutrality. In our life, it is a product that is shaped, and there is a momentum moving us toward or away from Him. Imperfectly, but nevertheless, ultimately, a choice is to be made. Christian behavior is the next section. What he means by Christian behavior is morality, and distinctly, he's talking about the issue of morality as consisting of three specific things. And it's important for us to catch this, because his analysis, I think, is right on point. He talks about the fact that most times when we think about morality, we're thinking about fair play and harmony between individuals. And so you have this whole idea of the first one would be the social dimension of morality. But he says there's another dimension of that, and that would be what we might call harmonizing the things inside the individual. So there'd be the personal morality. And then the third dimension that he talks about is the general purpose of human life. What was man made for? In other words, the idea of what we call teleology or purpose. And how does that fit? Where are we heading? It's like having ships at sea. It's one thing for the ships to be moving in proper alignment so that they're not heading toward each other. That they are moving, the fleet is moving in harmony. They're moving together. But it's another thing, though, if some of the ships are beginning to sink, or if there's something internally wrong with them. That's the other dimension. But the third aspect of morality is, where are they going? Are they just floating around, or are they heading toward a mission? What's their direction? Because, you see, it's possible for us to experience that good news, bad news story that the airline pilot breaks in and says, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is that we, due to a tailwind, we're making incredibly good time. The bad news is our nav system is out and we haven't a clue as to where we are. You see, what good does it do to be making good time on the whirlwind tour of oblivion? As you're moving fast toward oblivion, but, you know, where do you go? Where do you want to go? And so it's important for us to see that the morality consists of these kinds of dimensions. And his argument, of course, is usually all we think about is the social. Rarely do we talk about the personal dimension. And rarely do we talk about the issue of the purpose of life. And his argument here is if every individual human being is going to live forever, either that's true or false. Now, there are a good many things which would not be worth bothering about if I were going to live only 70 years, but which I'd better bother about very seriously if I'm going to live forever. He says, perhaps my bad temper or my jealousy are getting gradually worse, so gradually that the increase in 70 years will not be very noticeable. This is the point I mentioned earlier, but it might be absolute hell in a million years, you see. And so there's this movement here. In fact, if Christianity is true, hell is precisely the correct technical term for what it would be. And so he argues then that if individuals live only 70 years, then a state or a nation or a civilization, which may last for 1,000 years, is more important than an individual. But if Christianity is true, he argues, then the individual is not only more important, but incomparably more important, for he is everlasting, while the life of a state or a civilization compared with his is only a moment. Do you see where he's going here? That, therefore, we cannot ignore the personal dimension or the element of purpose without doing that to our peril. Jumping ahead, he talks about the cardinal virtues. How many of you have heard about this idea of the cardinal virtues and the theological virtues? You may be familiar with that. There are four cardinal virtues and three theological virtues. And the four cardinal virtues that he discusses and goes back really to the medieval schools for this are, and cardinal means like a hinge. These are hinge virtues. First of them is prudence. So now he's looking at virtue. So he's looking now at morality, not only in terms of social relationships, but in virtuous living in terms of our own lives. And how does that manifest itself in terms of our teleology, our destiny, our hope, our future? Where do these take us? He's embracing all of these. Prudence can be described as more than just common sense. It's taking the trouble to think about what you're doing and what's likely to come of it. God says, as he puts it, God wants a child's heart but a grown-up's head. He wants us to be simple, single-minded, affectionate, and teachable, as good children are. But he also wants every bit of intelligence we have to be alert at the job. And he's arguing that anyone who's honestly trying to be a Christian will soon find his intelligence being sharpened. And he's saying that because you're moving toward this worldview. Temperance, what do we usually associate with temperance? What do we usually think? You know, the temperance league, you know, and all that. Alcoholism, don't we? He says it's a bit more subtle than that. And he says, actually, doesn't mean specially to drink, but to all pleasures. It doesn't mean abstaining, but going the right length and no further. So it's not a question of going to one extreme or the other. He says, one great piece of mischief has been done by the modern restriction of the word temperance to the question of drink. Here's where Lewis will meddle with us. He says it helps people to forget that you can be just as intemperate about lots of other things. A man who makes his golf or his motorcycle, the center of his life, or a woman who devotes all her thoughts to clothes or bridge or a dog is being just as intemperate as someone who gets drunk every evening. Of course, it doesn't show on the outside so easily. Bridge mania or golf mania do not make you fall down in the middle of the road, but God is not deceived by externals. And so he says, basically, understand, we can be intemperate about a whole lot of other things than just drink. He goes on to the third one, and so he moves from prudence and temperance to the issue of justice. And by justice, it means more than just the sort of thing that goes on in law courts. It's basically anything we should now call fairness, honesty, give and take, truthfulness, keeping promises, all that sort of thing. And fortitude, the fourth of the cardinal virtues, fortitude has to do with the idea of both kinds of courage, and that is the kind that faces danger as well as the kind that sticks it out under pain. And so he describes these virtues then, and he says, in the same way, a man who perseveres in doing just actions gets in the end a certain quality of character, and it is that quality rather than the particular actions which we mean when we talk about virtue. And so he's talking about a character that is forged, and these are illustrations of virtues. And you notice how we've shifted in our culture from virtue to values. Have you noticed that change? It's a significant one. One is embedded in an absolute kind of way of thinking. One is relative and contextualized. And what happens then is it's no longer connected with an absolute structure. He talks about social morality. I won't spend much time on that. But he does meddle again when he talks about giving. And I don't know if I should mention this or not. You want to hear it? Okay, I'll let him meddle. I do not believe one can settle how much we ought to give. I am afraid the only safe rule is to give more than we can spare. He says, in other words, if our expenditure on comforts, luxuries, amusements, etc., is up to the standard common among those with the same income as our own, we're probably giving away too little. If our charities do not at all pinch or hamper us, I should say they are too small. There ought to be things we should like to do and cannot do because our charitable expenditure excludes them. And then he goes on to talk about the reason why we often don't is because of our fear of insecurity. And he develops that. Well, I said it. So he develops this, and all of us struggle with this sort of a thing. His basic line in this is this. I cannot learn how to love my neighbor as myself until I learn to love God, and I cannot learn to love God except by learning to obey Him. And obedience comes out of trust. And so he develops that theme. Then he has a little bit on morality and psychoanalysis, and basically says that God doesn't judge us on the raw material that we're given, but with what we've done with it. Some of us are frankly psychically more adjusted than other people. Would you agree with that? I mean, that idea that some people just have a natural disposition to have better material that they can build with and so forth. Some are less naturally neurotic or whatever. And there are all kinds of elements like that. He says it's not an issue of our actions. It's an issue of what we do with that which we've been given. And so there are some good people who really should have been great people given where they started. And there are some people who are mediocre who may be actually more virtuous than good people in one sense because of where they started. And so it's a question of relative to the heart rather than just God does not judge by external appearances, but by the internal attitude of the heart. And so it is the intention of the heart. And that's why comparing with other people can be systematically dangerous. You know, some of you may know from my teaching, I use an illustration observation from time to time about a fellow in Knoxville, Tennessee, who when he came to Christ, his life changed radically. But one of the things that didn't change right away was that he tended to swear, as he had always done all his life. And actually, the odd thing was, in his first year or so as a Christian, when he'd pray publicly, when he'd get carried away, he might swear in his prayers, in a public prayer. He says, "God, this stuff is so blankety blank real," and he'd go into that, and people would say, "Did I hear him say that?" And they might say, and indeed the fellow needed to come along, but you can see what would happen. Some people who are so focused on legalism that you say the right thing and do the right at the right time, it's possible, is it not, for a legalistic person to be have the appearance of righteousness. He says all the words, knows the terminology, and yet he's just misrepresented a product on a deal, or he's lied to a customer. And he knows he's done that. And he may confess to God, but he's unwilling to make it right with the person that he's done. The other fellow is swearing because he's immature. You can see where I'm going. The first person gives the appearance of obedience when he's actually in disobedience. The second person gives the appearance of disobedience when he's actually, at that point in his life, pleasing the heart of God, because God knows his heart. So external appearances can be systematically deceptive. That's the sort of thing that I think is tricky about all of this. It's not always what it seems to be. But he's saying the central part of you, the part of you that chooses, every time you make a choice, it moves a little bit different from where it was before. And taking your whole life, with all your innumerable choices, all your life long, you're out slowly turning the central thing either into a heavenly creature or into a hellish creature. Either into a creature that is in harmony with God and with other creatures and with itself, or else one that is in a state of war and hatred with God. Because you see, if we go back to this idea of morality, those are the three elements. Are you in harmony with God is the issue of moral purpose. Are you in harmony with yourself? So this is God. Are you in harmony with yourself, and are you in harmony with others? And his argument is we cannot be in harmony with others without that being in place, being in harmony with ourselves, nor can we be in harmony with ourselves until we are in harmony with God. And so all three of these really connect together into a coherent whole, and that's why his argument is if you truncate it and just focus on others, you really don't have the source of power, the wellspring through which you can really attain the kind of life that he's talking about. He then goes into sexual morality, and I believe I'll pass over that because it really is a meddling chapter. No, actually, I would love to go into it, but we do not have time to develop all of this book, so I'll move on from there. But he does say this, the issue really comes out of habits of the whole soul, where we learn that we cannot trust ourselves even in our best moments, and on the other, that we need not despair even in our worst, for our failures are forgiven. So there's a wonderful balance here of grasping the meaning of this. And he talks about the kinds of sins, the sins of the flesh, versus the sins of the spirit. He says the diabolical self is the worse than the animal self. This is why a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. But of course, it's better to be neither. So he says basically, though, that it's the sins, the dark sins of the spirit that can be, and that's why, as we'll see, Dante doesn't put, he puts people who commit sins of the flesh, they're not as far down as people with the sins of pride and of malice and so forth. But that's another matter. Talks about Christian marriage and has a marvelous section on that. Bottom line there, feelings come and go. Ceasing to be in love doesn't mean ceasing to love. And he says that marriage is a deep unity maintained by the will and deliberately strengthened by habit. And so that we seek grace to be able to sustain that, because of the changing quality of our circumstances, ups and downs, and so forth. And so he talks about that and then connects it. It's interesting that he moves right from there into forgiveness and talks about the idea of loving my enemies. It doesn't mean I need to like them, but I can still choose to love them. In fact, I find myself, he says, really making a marvelous distinction between the sin and the sinner. You know where I do that consistently? Myself. Even though I don't often like myself, I still draw a distinction between the sin and the sinner. I say, you know, so when you do something, you realize that's really not the, that's really not me, we might say. When someone else does it, we can't disconnect the two. So he talks about how I show charity to myself, and I'm called to say that, show that same charity to others. He says that we are to, be people who forgive. What matters really is those little marks or twists on the central inside part of the soul, which are going to turn it in the long run either into a heavenly or hellish creature. The same theme that we've seen before. He talks about the great sin of pride before he moves into the theological virtues. Pride is the worst sin of all. He says there's no fault which makes a man more unpopular and no fault which we are more unconscious of in ourselves. The more we have it ourselves, the more we dislike it in others. That's the danger of pride and conceit. Pride is essentially a competitive sin. It's competitive in its very nature. While the other vices are competitive only, so to speak, by accident, pride gets no pleasure out of having something, only out of having more of it than the next man. We may say that people are proud of being rich or clever or good looking, but they are not. They are proud of being richer or cleverer or better looking than others. And so he says, but you know, when we come up against God, there's an end to pride. In God, you come up against something which is in every respect immeasurably superior to yourself. Unless you know God as that, and therefore know yourself as nothing in comparison, you don't know God at all. And so he talks about the corresponding virtue of humility, and ultimately moves into charity, and moves us into the three theological virtues. And so we have charity, we have faith, he puts them in this order. No, actually, I think he does faith last. So he has a chapter on charity, then he has hope, and then he has two chapters on faith. And this whole issue of charity and hope and faith, hope, and love is what we've got here, are these theological virtues by which he means charity is more than an emotional feeling, but a love of the will. Here's where he makes this important, a couple of key statements that I want you to hear. Do not waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. As soon as you do this, you'll find out one of the great secrets. When you are behaving as if you love someone, you will presently come to love him. There is this whole process of acting yourself into a new way of being as a process of that. Good and evil both increased at compound interest. That is why the little decisions you and I make every day are of such infinite importance. An apparently trivial indulgence in lust or anger today is the loss of a ridge or a railway line or bridgehead from which the enemy may launch an attack otherwise impossible. You can see the war imagery from when he was writing this. And so he says, act as if you do love a person. Don't try sitting and manufacturing feelings. Ask yourself, if I were sure that I love God, what would I do? When you have found the answer, go and do it. And so he talks about it being an affair of the will. Then he moves on to this issue of hope. And his issue is that we must relate hope to a deep and profound longing that all of us have that is not to be satisfied in this world. That we have a longing in our deep heart of hearts. And Lewis deals with this in several of his books. He calls it Sehnsucht, this idea of a desire that goes beyond our grasp. And he says that these arise in us, but they evoke something else. And he then makes this argument. If I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. And so he says, let those longings in your deep heart of hearts, which cannot be satisfied in any person or position or possession, let those longings actually evoke the truth that you're homesick, that you're longing for home, and that you seek a country that you have not yet seen. And you are waiting for that, and there are hints of home and the realization that you're not home yet, that you are a stranger and an alien, but that God is preparing you for such an existence that is beyond your comprehension. And so he develops this whole theme. Faith, he talks about, and he describes faith in the sense of the art of holding on to things your reason has once accepted in spite of your changing moods. He does not draw a distinction. He doesn't draw a separation between faith and reason. But he's saying that real faith is to cling to the things that your reason has seen to be so, in spite of the fact that your moods and circumstances vacillate. So I'm fond of saying this truth, that you can either judge your circumstances in light of God's character, or you can judge God's character in light of your circumstances. There's a choice that you will make, one way or another. And so faith has to do with this issue of clinging to him, and that faith must be fed, therefore. And all of these things then, realization that all these things come ultimately from God himself. Having developed that, we move into the last book, which is Beyond Personality, or The First Steps in the Doctrine of the Trinity, and immediately he starts off in this whole theme of making and begetting. And what he says here, and this is important for us to grasp, he says the issue of making and begetting are radically different. Making has to do, remember it says, begotten, not made in the Creed, speaking of Christ, a very important distinction. Because that which is begotten, when you beget something of the same kind as yourself. So a human begets human babies. A beaver begets little beavers, and so forth. And God begets God. But what we have there is the whole idea that there is the eternal procession, that there was never a time when Christ was not. But there is an image that we use. But when you make, what happens? You make something of a different kind from yourself. So a bird makes a nest, a beaver builds a dam, and a man makes a computer or whatever, a car. The fact is that we have to get something clearer. What God begets is God, what man begets is man. And so, thus, in this context, there is always going to be a creator-creation distinction. But he goes on to say, though, that there's yet some way in which we can move from being made into being begotten in a spiritual way. And he talks about this idea of bios, that all people have biological life, and then contrast that with the need for zoe, which is spiritual life. And so in this section, he discusses this very issue. That the spiritual life which is in God from all eternity, which made the whole natural universe, is Zoe. That's the spiritual life. Bios has, to be sure, a certain shadowy or symbolic resemblance to Zoe, but only the sort of resemblance there is between a photo and a place, a statue and a man. And so he talks about the fact that Christianity is a great sculpture's shop. This world is a great sculpture shop. We are the statues, and there is a rumor going about the shop that some of us are going to someday come to life. And there is this idea here that we will have this new life of God, and that is what he's offering. So the idea is that the whole purpose for which we exist is to be taken into the Zoe of God. So that nobody has this Zoe until it is infused in us, and God offers us his very life in this process. Having spoken about this idea, he moves on into time and God's relationship with time. His argument is that God transcends time, and as you may well know, there's a lot of issues and debates these days about views of time. There's even a book just been published, Four Views of Time, from a Christian point of view. I would lean toward Lewis's concept that God is outside the boundaries of time, and it relates to the mystery of free will. The mystery of divine sovereignty and human responsibility, because God sees all things in the present now. And so Lewis develops that theme. Then he goes on from there to talk about the good infection. And that Christ, who is the self-expression of the Father, is in fact inviting himself into our lives. And we are being invited into the life of the Trinity, which is almost a kind of drama that he uses. So Trinitarian life is a kind of drama where you have a movement and you have a dance, and you have this whole concept here of being welcomed into the very heart of things, that God, it requires there to be more than one person. As he says, the words God is love has no real meaning unless God contains at least two persons. Love is something that one person has for another person. If God were as a single person, then before the world was made, he was not love. That's a very profound observation, because that makes Christianity unique, utterly unique. The mystery of the Trinity, there are three theistic religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. It is significant that it is Christianity that talks about a love and intimacy, a father-son relationship, a lover-beloved relationship that relates to this whole idea of personhood, and because personhood finds its ultimate expression in the very character of God, who in fact is a mystery. He is a community. God is a community of being. And it is that in which we are being invited. So as he kind of moves the book to the conclusion, I'd like to read an important statement. The Son of God became of man to enable men to become sons of God. I want to read that again because it's such a one phrase zinger that is really good. The Son of God became a man to enable men to become sons of God. That is the whole concept of the calling. That we're being turned from created beings into begotten beings. Not that we are little gods, but that ultimately we are being called into the reception of his very nature. And having said that, he talks about this concept here of a good infection that you're catching from a person. Not something you're trying to do or to achieve, but something that you are received, that you're receiving from him. In this very chapter, by the way, he's talking about this whole idea that understand that there will be imperfection in other carriers of Christianity. They will not be perfect in this world. And thus he goes on to say, never pin your whole faith on any human being. Not if he is the best and wisest in the whole world. There are lots of nice things you can do with sand, but do not try building a house on it. The only one you can truly cast yourself utterly upon with reckless abandon is the unchanging character of the living God. And that will then infuse a life in you, which then spills over into your relationships with others. So as you move from the inside out, it will begin to qualitatively give you a source of power of reality in life, which will move us into the ability to become people of virtue, of character, of hope, of purpose, of all these qualities being infused in us, both the theological and cardinal virtues. Is Christianity hard or easy? Well, he says in one sense it's easy, in another way it's hard. The almost impossible thing is to hand over your whole self, all your wishes and precautions to Christ. And so he says that's very difficult. But it's far easier than what we are all trying to do instead. What we're trying to do is to remain what we call ourselves, to keep personal happiness as our great aim in life, and yet to try to be good. And he's saying, ultimately, the way you come to this life is by dying to the other, to the old. And so he says, when he said be perfect, he meant it. He meant that we must go in for the full treatment. It is hard. But the sort of compromise we are all hankering after is harder. In fact, it's impossible. It may be hard for an egg to turn into a bird. It would be a jolly sight harder for it to learn to fly while remaining an egg. We are eggs, like eggs at present. And you cannot go on indefinitely being just an ordinary, decent egg. We must be hatched or go bad. The hatching, I think, is our death and resurrection. But right now, we're moving from there, and there's a hatching process, and we're going to move away from that. He then uses this wonderful illustration that I often have used about the problem of when he was a child. You know, he often had a toothache, and he'd tell his mom she'd give him aspirin, but then what would he do? What would she do? He knew this was a problem. That's why he didn't want to tell her until it got really bad. He knew she'd do more than give him the aspirin, which would alleviate the pain. He'd also take her to a dentist. And he says, well, you know what those dentists are like? As he puts it, he says, I could not get what I wanted out of her without getting something more, which I did not want. I wanted immediate relief from pain, but I couldn't get it without having my teeth set permanently right. And I knew of those dentists. I knew that they started fiddling about with all sorts of other teeth, which had not yet begun to ache. They would not let sleeping dogs lie. If you give them an inch, they took an L. They take it all. You see the idea? And he says, that's what God is like. He says, you may want to have enough of Christianity to get a little bit better in your marriage or your business or your perspective on life, whatever. But he says, that's fine. He'll cure that, perhaps. But that's not all you're going to get. Once you call him in, he's going to give you the full treatment. And that's the problem here. He's beginning to move you towards something far, far greater. God is easily to please, but hard to satisfy. He says, you thought you were going to be made into a decent little cottage. That's why he brings in pain, a rough time, hardships in our lives, putting us in situations where we have to be more brave or more patient or more loving than we ever dreamed of being before. It seems to us unnecessary, but that's because we haven't yet had the slightest notion of the tremendous thing he means to make of us. You thought you were going to be made into a decent little cottage, but he is really building a palace. He intends to come and live in it himself. Now listen to this example of Lewis's writings here. The command to be perfect is not idealistic gas, nor is it a command to do the impossible. He is going to make us into creatures that can obey that command. He said in the Bible that we were gods, and he is going to make good his words. If we let him, for we can prevent him, if we choose, he will make the feeblest and filthy of us into a god or goddess, dazzling, radiant, immortal creatures, pulsating all through with such energy and joy and wisdom and love as we cannot now imagine. A bright stainless mirror which reflects back to God perfectly, though of course in a smaller scale, his own boundless power and delight and goodness. This process will be long and in parts very painful, but that is what we are in for, nothing less. He meant what he said. Let me conclude with the last chapter when he talks about this whole idea of being under new management and moving us into becoming the new men, the new kind of people. Not mere improvement, but transformation. And he says, you know, if you thought about where humans are going to go, you might have thought we would evolve into something with bigger brains or more power and so forth. And he says, actually, it's a new kind of power. It's something far more subtle than you would have supposed. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if when the thing happened, very few people noticed it was happening. Now, if you care to talk in these terms, the Christian's view is precisely that the next step has already appeared. And it's really new. It's not a change from brainy men to brainier men. It is a change that goes off in a totally different direction, a change from being creatures of God to being sons of God. And so he takes up on this theme and concludes in his book with this marvelous ending. He makes these comments. The more we get over what we now call ourselves out of the way and let him take us over, the more truly ourselves we become. So he goes on to say, it's no use trying to be myself without him. The more I resist him and try to live on my own, the more I become dominated by my own heredity and upbringing and surroundings and natural desires. In other words, what he is saying is that as you become more like Christ, you become more uniquely the person you were meant to be, not a clone. But now you're no longer going to be defined by nature and nurture, by heredity and environment. But now there's that in you which has a signal of transcendence where you cannot account for that. There's something about him that has the smell of the presence, the fragrance of God himself. And that is what he's saying, that is Christ in you. And he's arguing then that when we abandon the quest to try to become unique, we become unique. By losing our life, we find it in him. As long as your own personality is what you're bothering about, you're never going to go to him at all. The very first thing is to try to forget about the self altogether. Your real new self, which is Christ and also yours and yours just because it is him, his, will not come as long as you are looking for it. It will come when you're looking for him. Give up yourself and you will find your real self. Lose your life and you will save it. Submit to death, death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day, death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will ever be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ and you will find him, and with him, everything else thrown in. Let me pray. Father, we thank you that you have a purpose for us, a glorious destiny, greater than that which we would have chosen for ourselves. Left to ourselves, we would have just sought for modest pleasures and ambitions. But you have something greater than that for us. It is your intention to make us fully conform to the image of our Son. May we long for that, though we fear the process. May we trust you in what you take us through in order to bring about that utter satisfaction of becoming the people that you intended us to be all along, and thus to realize that you are never the enemy of our joy, but you are the wellspring of all good things. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.
This concludes Dr. Ken Boa's teaching. For more information about Reflections Ministries, please visit us on the web at www.reflectionsministries.org.